back for my crime. What a weekend. Funny how time can fly.
Welcome. This is Wish Upon a Star. I'm your host, Andell Banks. Wish Upon a Star is an exciting program that will showcase up-and-coming stars in the musical, visual, performing, creative, and literary arts arena. We will discuss with professional guests about songwriting, entertainment law, copywriting, and other topics. It now gives us great pleasure to introduce our guest, Mr. John St. Amour. Mr. St. Amour is a supervisory senior copyright information specialist at the United States Copyright Office. He handles about copyright law from the public, from attorneys, and industry professionals. Mr. Moore often delivers copyright presentations to the American Library Association, Grammys, the Recording Academy, and guides public tours of the Library of Congress historical Jefferson Building. He has served as the copyright liaison for registration to Sony Music and Cherry Lane Music. Mr. St. Amour, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
What I'm going to do is just go over some preliminary and basic questions that maybe some of our listeners take for granted, but you can more thoroughly explain it to them. Well, let's just start from the beginning. What is copyright?
That's a very loaded question. Copyright, in its most layman terms, literally means the right to copy a work. And that's where it comes from. That's where the copyright comes from, which is why it's C-O-P-Y-R-I-G-H-T. Today, under the law, copyright really is called a bundle of rights that includes really five basic tenets, which is when a person creates a work, they have certain exclusive rights. And that includes the right to reproduce their work, which is means like to make copies of their work, the right to distribute their work, so they could the exclusive right to publish or otherwise get their work out there, the right to prepare derivative works, that is a new work based upon the work of which they created, and the right to display the work or perform the work publicly, depending on the type of work. And finally, to have digital audio transmissions of their work. So those are the bundle of exclusive rights that are afforded to the creator or author of a work. So when someone says copyright, that's what they mean. They basically mean those five basic rights that are provided for in the copyright law to all creators of artistic works.
Oh, that's fine. I also want to let you know that you can extend your answers for as long as you like.
Okay.
So there is no limit on that once we get that great understanding. So basically on that answer that you just gave, copyright initially protects the person who has that particular material.
That's right. So under the law, as soon as a person creates a work that falls under copyright protection, which would be works in the visual arts, such as paintings, drawings, sculptural works, graphic artworks, works in the performing arts, such as movie scripts, songs, sound recordings, movies themselves, or works of literary nature. So any text, really, a written book, their poetry, an article, a blog on the web. Those are the kinds of types of works, in big picture, of works that are protected by copyright. And the moment you create a work and have it in a fixed format, then you own the copyright to it. Registration with the Copyright Office isn't required, although the law does provide some benefits to the creator of the work for making a public record of their copyright ownership.
Oh, I see. I know you said movies and scripts and books, and lots of times when we do see different articles like that, if we purchase them, we see the letter TM. So we have also heard of patent and trademark. How
right.
is a copyright different from a patent or a trademark?
Patent and trademarks are different types of intellectual property. Copyright is one type of intellectual property. Patents is generally reserved for inventions, and trademarks are the concept of trademarking really falls when you're trying to brand something that you've created, either a business or a product or a service associated with trade. And so with trademarks, you typically see things like logos or the names of the businesses or a slogan. Take, for example, Nike, right? There's only one Nike that produces certain products under the name Nike. And they also have their own logo, which is the swoosh, the Nike swoosh. It's kind of an abstracted check mark, so to speak. And also
yeah.
they have different monikers that they use, such as Just Do It. And all that falls under trademark law. Copyright doesn't protect those areas of intellectual property. That's where trademark would come in. So if somebody is creating their own business, and they want to have the name of their business or their logo or a slogan protected, they would have to do that through trademark laws, or possibly state laws as well for starting up businesses. But copyright doesn't protect those areas.
Okay, so now we've got the rights, we've got the protection. If copyright protection is automatic, why should I have to register my work?
There are certain benefits that the law provides to a person who goes ahead and makes a public record of their copyright ownership. Some of those benefits include, one, the ability to defend their copyright in court. U.S. federal courts make registration a prerequisite to filing in their jurisdiction. So if you found yourself in the unfortunate situation where someone has infringed your copyright, you would need the registration before you could sue them, civil suit in federal court. Your registration can also be used if, for example, you know that copies of your work are being made offshore outside of the United States and those copies are being imported back in the United States. There's a procedure where department, I think it all falls through Homeland Security, I think these days, where you can get Border Patrol to help stop the importation of the works. Of course, it makes a public record, a person who infringes the work, if there was no copyright on record, and a person did not put a copyright notice on their work, for example, they could claim that while they understand they infringed the work, that it was an innocent infringement, and try to use that as a defense against statutory damages. If a registration is made, a timely registration is made, and a copyright notice is put on a work, that defense becomes very difficult for them to rely on. And speaking of statutory damages, when a registration is made in a timely fashion from when the work is created or within a certain time frame of being published, then the copyright owner can be awarded statutory damages in the case of a winning lawsuit. So those are among some of the benefits of filing the copyright registration. And really, in layman's terms, what I find when people call our office or I talk to people whose works have been infringed, and in cases where they're making the copyright registration after the infringement has already occurred, they basically say, they wish they had done it earlier. They thought that, that since copyright is automatic, that they'd have these protections already in place. And then they find out that by not registering in a timely fashion, that they lost out on some of their ability to defend their work. And so their works might have been used illegally for a longer period of time than they would have liked had they made a timely registration. So in essence, while the work is under protection, the law applies, copyright law applies to works even if they're not registered with our office, the advantages are so great that it really seems to make sense for a person to make a registration, especially if they're an artist who's putting their work out there. You know, if you're sort of making the work and, you know, and keeping it to yourself in your own, you know, living room or bedroom, and nobody ever knows that the work is being created, then perhaps registration doesn't have a great value. But most artists who I know, whether they be a visual artist or a performing artist or a writer, they tend to want to put their work out there for people to enjoy it. That's a part of being a creator is letting other people in on your creations. And so for those people, registration really provides a very solid benefit for them. And it's encouraged for them to make the registration. The law encourages them to make that registration.
That is really interesting, and I'm certain that a lot of our listeners can really identify with that. Even 20 and 25 years later, we have heard of infringement against people's work. So thank you for that. Mm-hmm. We have also heard, John, about the phrase starving artists.
Yes.
No money. Is there such a thing as a poor man's copyright?
Well, there's a wonderful myth out there regarding poor man's copyright. I'm not sure exactly where it comes from. I think it may come from some very old English laws, not really laws, but maybe the way courts made some decisions. But in under U.S. law, there really is no provision for poor man's copyright. If you read through the copyright law and how a work can be registered and what's needed in order to go to court and to defend your copyright, nowhere in the law will you find something called poor man's copyright. Nowhere will you find an instance where someone can mail something to themselves in a sealed envelope and somehow that, you know, the date stamp on the postage shows when you created a work. There's even these days, and I would hope that most people would be aware of that. What I tend to find is there's sort of these new online versions, these new electronic versions of a poor man's copyright, where you'll see businesses really created who they say, well, you can register all of your works with us or submit all of your works with us, and we'll put an electronic date on their, when you submit it to us. We'll verify. And so we see similar things popping up on the internet, and they usually charge some low fee, an annual fee of $10 or something for all of their works, and they can add on and keep it going indefinitely. I don't know of anything successfully litigated where that was used to support specifically that idea of time dating. The only place in the law that talks about a registration is in the copyright law, and talking about what we call an effective date of registration, and that date is the date that's used, could be used for, in terms of when we talk about earlier statutory damages, that effective date of registration becomes crucial. Nowhere in the copyright law will you see an effective time or date submitted to an electronic service outside of the Copyright Office. So the effective date of registration really has to do with a copyright registration with the U.S. Copyright Office. And the courts recognize that because we're a government agency, we're not partial, we're not manipulating the system to any of our real benefits. So, the poor man's copyright is indeed poor. And it really doesn't provide any benefits outside of feeling good that you mailed something to yourself, I suppose. But you can save your postage out there.
Right. I'm glad we put that to rest, because I know somebody somewhere is thinking that, because I've heard of people doing that, exactly what you had said in your example.
I had a phone call 30 minutes ago about the same topic. Somebody asked me, do I have to register, or can I just mail this to myself? And I had to go through the exact same scenario. Yeah. It's a pervasive myth. That seems, regardless of how much we try here at the Copyright Office to squelch it, it seems to continue on through the generations.
But I'll help you along with that.
Thank you.
Also, in that particular vein, we are now a global world, so lots of people have copyrights. But then let's say I move out of the country, out of the United States, and I go to another country. Is my copyright good in other countries?
Copyright is territorial. Each country, most countries, have some sort of copyright laws. And the United States has agreements. We're party to either conventions or treaties. We have other agreements sometimes, either, you know, directly with a country. But for the most part, there are these large conventions or treaties that countries belong to, the Berne Convention for the intellectual property, WIPO members, which is the World Intellectual Property Organization. And with that, the countries come usually to some sort of agreement that we have some tenets, some basic aspects of copyright that we all agree upon by being part of that treaty or convention or whatever agreement that is. And in that is usually language that provides for copyright that is recognized in one country to be recognized in any one of those countries with whom we have relations under their laws. So under their terms of copyright, under their whatever's needed in their country in terms of defending your copyright would all fall under their copyright laws. But so it's not exactly reciprocity, but any country with whom we have copyright relations, that country should recognize under these treaties and conventions, should recognize a copyright of an American citizen. Now, you may have to file a registration in that country. Again, you have to follow the laws within that country. But the protection should be there, yes.
Okay, fine, and I'm sure it's the same thing if people from other countries come here and have that same type.
Well, even if they don't come here, any citizen or a person domiciled in any country with whom we have relations, their works would be protected, even if published, or if a work is published in any country of which we hold copyright relations with. And if a work is unpublished, then the United States will acknowledge the copyright ownership of any person in the world for an unpublished work. So even if the person resides in a country with whom we don't specifically have copyright relations, we would engage with that person as an individual. Now, if their work was published in that country only, then it might not be recognized here. But the United States, we get them all the time, registrations from all over the world. And part of the reason is because we're one of the few countries that has such a robust and organized copyright registration system. And our records that we've been keeping here since 1870. And many countries that have copyright don't have copyright registration. And their laws work very differently. And so one of the reasons that many people around the world make registrations with our country is because we have such an organized registration system. And it's almost unparalleled. There are very few countries that have such a system like ours, a registration system like ours.
Well, that's great, and I'm glad we do, because I like a lot of the art that comes from the other countries at the museums. At this time, John, we're going to take a little pause.
Great.
And we'll be right back with an interlude of Because of Your Love by John Butler.
Yes.
Have our copyright anywhere, but also in the digital world, can you copyright a website and a domain name?
The content of a website can be protected by copyright. So, you know, what are the kinds of things that people put on a website? People often put text on a website, information about whatever the topic is covering the website. Sometimes they add photographs. They might even stream video or audio files on their website. All of that is content. Copyright doesn't protect a website per se, just like copyright doesn't protect a book. It protects the content in a book. A book could be a coffee table book, could contain text that could also contain photographs or could contain both. In the same vein, a website is really just a vehicle for content to exist. And so copyright can protect that content. Copyright does not protect the name of the website or the domain name. Again, that could be something, if it was like a company name, like a company name .com, as we talked about earlier, that the company name could maybe something subject to trademark protection, but copyright wouldn't protect that. Of course, there's also the domain registry, which helps to provide so that there's only one soandso.com or soandso.org that exists out there, because those names refer to an IP address, a specific address. So there's official companies out there who handle domain names. But copyright really just extends to web content. And when a person files a registration for their web content, they're sending us copies of that content in some avenue or another, either in a digital format or printing out screenshots, or somehow we're getting that content as part of the registration. Over time, websites, often the content changes. So periodic registrations with the office might be prudent to somebody who is making regular registrations with our office. Who's making regular updates to their website. They may want to file, registrations from time to time to cover that new content that they continue to add onto their website.
Why would a person want to copyright a website or a domain name in view of the fact of what you just said, that there might be numerous changes or they might go out of business and don't use that same website? I mean, is there any particular reason why you think they would do that?
Well, I think people make registrations for their content on a website the same reason they do for any other work they're putting out there. You have content that you've created that you're, that you're exposing on the internet, and the internet, as you know, is fairly easy to copy a work and paste it or put it into another website or photographs is very common. I mean, unless someone has put a lock on their photograph, most people can right click right onto a photograph, save it into their computer, and put it on their hard drive. So I think on the website, because it can be seen by anybody, theoretically by anybody in the world, the exposure is much greater when their work is put on the internet. So copyright protection really for that person becomes even more important because of the increased exposure. So a person would want to file a registration in order to prevent other websites or other people from utilizing that web content.
Oh, okay. Let's go a little further to something that's a little more peculiar, but people do it. Let's say I know it's my work, I can prove it's my work. Does my work have to be published in order to be protected?
No. As we talked earlier, copyright protection begins once a work is created. If any of your radio listeners out there are doodling something on a notepad, make a little picture, when they put their pen down, they own the copyright to that little doodle right then. But it doesn't need to be published to have protection. That work certainly can exist and even be have a very high level of exposure without it being published. For example, a songwriter may not publish sheet music or even put out a CD, but that songwriter might be going around to their local taverns or other performing spaces and performing their songs live. And they might even get a following of people who say, wow, everywhere Mike goes, I'm going to go to that place to listen to Mike play his songs because I really love his songs. So people become aware and they start hearing this song over and over again, and they start to know the lyrics and the music, and the work may not be published, and yet their work is being put out there. An artist might create a mural or some other work that is seen by the public. Every day, people might pass by some sort of artwork that's been put up, and so people are aware of it. Oh, did you see the mural on 16th Street? No, I didn't see that. Oh, you got to go check it out. And so works can very much be out and exposed to people without it being published, and copyright will protect the unpublished works equally as they would the published works.
I see what you're saying, that exposure to so many other elements and regions, well, you need a protection. Let's say my name. I love my name, and I also made up a slogan. Are these two other things that are possibly could be a part of a copyright protection?
No. We talked earlier about the difference between trademark and patent in comparison to copyright. Patents, again, being along the lines of inventions. Trademark can protect any name, possibly a name, but that isn't something that copyright protects.
Oh, okay. Okay, I finished my work. I've published it. Now, how do I go about registering my work?
There are two ways to file a registration. Well, really, there's one good way and one okay way. There are two ways to file a registration. We have paper forms that have basically gone unchanged since the current law went into effect in 1978.
Right.
And so people might be familiar with those forms. Those tend to be the forms that you can get at your local library if they have a book of old copyright registration information. And we still accept those forms. People send them in. But about 93-94% of the registrations that come into our office actually come through electronically. About 5 years ago, we started an online registration system called the Electronic Copyright Office, or ECO, which is just the first letter of each of those words. Some people call it ECHO. Some people call it ECO. I don't think, even within this office, we can't come to an agreement, I think, on that. But the Electronic Copyright Office is an online registration system. To use it, a person would go to our website, which is copyright.gov, and they would click the link to the Electronic Copyright Office, and they would have to create a user account, which is free to do. You know, you're basically creating a profile. Just like if you're going to buy something on Amazon or eBay or someplace, you got to create a little profile. So the profile questions are fairly basic. You know, what's your name? What's your address? You know, you have a phone number. What's your email address? And then the user chooses their own user ID, like a handle, how they want to identify themselves and for login purposes. And also they create a password. Now, a lot of people, when they're creating their password, they get tripped up because this is a government agency. And the United States federal government has more strict rules in terms of creating a password. And so you just have to comply. There's a little link there, a help link, when people are creating their password to get a little guidance there. So they create their user ID, which could be anything that they want, and then they create a password. They already have their other profile information, and they create their login. And then once the person is logged in, then they file their registration through that online system. Just like the paper form, in essence, there are three steps involved in filing a copyright registration. There's an application, which, when you're in the online system, is really a series of screens where you're going through answering questions on the screens. For example, the screen might ask, what type of work are you registering? Another screen will ask, has the work ever been published? Another screen will ask, who's the author? Another one will ask, who's the claimant? And some basic information about the work and the person or people who created the work. That's the application. Once the person gets through the application, then they need to submit a payment. When you file online, it's usually $55, although there are some works where there's a discounted rate of $35. If you file a paper application, it's $85. So clearly we're encouraging you to use the online system with the lower rates. And then after the payment is made, a person submits the work to us. Again, through the online system, all unpublished works can be submitted to us electronically, so they can just upload a copy of their work. Obviously, if it's a sculptural work, you can't upload a sculpture, but you can upload the photographs of a sculpture, which is what we're looking for anyway, is ID material. Or if a work is published only, has been published, but it's only been published in a digital format. So it's only available as a, you know, musical work as a digital download, or it's only available as an e-book, or it's only available on a website, and that's where the work has been placed. and they're considering those works to be published, they can also send electronic copies of those works. If, however, the work has been published in a print form or a physical form, usually we want the person to send up to two copies of that work to our office. Even if you file online, there's still a procedure for getting us those physical copies. So we always encourage people, regardless of whether the work is unpublished or published electronically or published in a print form, we encourage people to file through the online system. And as I said, it's around 93-94%, could be a little higher, I'm not sure. But it's around that rate right now, paper versus electronic. The vast majority of registrations are coming in electronically, and a very small percentage of applications come in on the paper forms.
All right, great. You also answered my next question about filing online. We're going to take another short break and a station break, and we'll be right back.
Hey. Just get loose.
Get straight.
Get that thing.
What up, y'all? Just came to your city to say what's up.
What up?
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Show me love.
Show me love.
Hey.
Hop off the plane to a new show.
What up?
And all the shorties, they be waiting on me. Thugs packing they pistols. But ain't nobody aiming on me. Got a pocket full of fresh dough. So you know I got a bacon, homie. And I'm thankful. Get whatever you want, it's on me. New songs on the radio.
I want to say this is Andell Banks, your host at Wish Upon a Star on station BBSradio.com, station 2, every first and third Wednesday, Eastern Standard Time at 2 o'clock. Please pass on the word and listen. We'll welcome back our guest, Mr. John Amore, St. Amore, from the U.S. Copyright Office. Thanks a lot, John, for that last comment on how we can register our work online, or you can send it in where, as you said, 93% of the people actually send it in online. You also mentioned some of the general fees. Could you repeat that again? Because I know that's always a great interest for people. How much does it cost?
When you file a paper application, the current filing fee for that is $85, which is a little steep. We have in the online system, it's $30 less. So a standard registration when using the online system is $55. And it is not $55 per work that you create. You can register a collection of works together. For example, if I'm a poet, rarely do poets write just one poem. They usually write multiple poems and often distribute them in collections of poetry. And a registration can extend to that entire collection or a collection of songs.
Okay, good.
There are some caveats to that. Now, if a person is only, and like I said, that's $55. Now, if an individual is only registering one song or one poem or one painting or drawing or one work and there's just one author, then there is a discounted rate of $35 for that one work. But otherwise, the standard registration, which is the vast majority of registrations, is $55.
Oh, okay, great. I understand also with the paper application, when they send it in, do they have to send in the original? And if they do, do they get it back? Do you have a provision for that?
No, any copy of a work that is submitted to us, we retain that copy. If it's a published work, we may be forwarding that to the Library of Congress for them to decide whether they want to include it in their collections or not. But we retain the copies. We do not return copies of works. So if someone, and this does happen sometimes, where someone is registering an unpublished work, we encourage them, make a copy of the work. Don't send us your only sole copy in the world because you won't be getting it back. So make a copy of the work. Obviously, if it's a published work, then we're just looking for, you know, one or two published copies. But no, we do not return the copy, and that's why we call it a copy. We're not looking for your original handwritten work. It can be, you can photocopy or send us, some sort of other acceptable version.
Oh, okay, great. You also answered one of the questions about bundling. I know I had one guest about music, and they have to have their work copyrighted. Did they have to do each individual? So you're saying you can, and you do have a bundle fee. Is that just for poets, or is it for other people too, like authors?
Yeah, the poets, that's just an example. Any author who creates multiple works, there are some caveats. In other words, there are some limitations. For example, to register a collection of works together, if the works are unpublished, then each work needs to be created and owned by the same person or persons. For example, if I on my own wrote 10 songs, I could register those 10 songs together in a single registry, in one registration. Or if you and I co-wrote 10 songs together, we could file one registration because each of the 10 songs were written by the pair of us. However, if I wrote 5 songs on my own and then co-wrote 5 songs with you, that's not the same authorship. I'd have to separate that into 2 separate registrations, one for the collection of songs that I created and then another registration for the collection of songs that, where you and I were co-authors. If a work is published, then only works that have been published together in the same unit of publication, for example, the 5 songs that I wrote by myself that were all published together on the same album, on the same demo, those could be registered together. But if I have some songs that were published on one album and then some other songs that were published on other albums, even if I've never made a registration before, I wouldn't be able to combine all that. I have to separate it out based on the unit of publication. So there are some limitations, and this is probably a good time to point out, too, that as you know, all this information is available on our website, which is copyright.gov. One of the great areas that we have is a publication section, which has what we call circulars and brochures. Circular is just an old kind of arcane word for publications that are circulated to the public.
Right.
And each circular is hits a different topic. Circular 1 is copyright basics, which gives the big picture overview of copyright. But then there are, I think, maybe 70 or 80 circulars, all on different topics. For example, Circular 50 is one that musicians, composers would like to read, because Circular 50 talks specifically about filing registrations for music, or Circular 40 if you're a visual artist, if you're a painter or sculptor, or you have jewelry design. Circular 40 would talk about that. So each circular has these different topics, and it's all laid out in fairly layman language, fairly simple language. Every now and then, there's some technical language in there, and of course, they can always contact the Copyright Office if they need anything beyond that. But beyond the circulars, but the circulars do a very good job explaining what needs to be done when you're per topic. So our website is a very valuable resource.
Oh, great, excellent. I'm certain we can certainly use that information. And like, again, we said, all this information is online under the copyright.gov website. John, I have filled in a lot of personal information when I sent in that application on the necessary forms. Will any of my personal information be available to the public's eye?
Well, this is an Office of Public Record. And therefore registrations and registration information does become part of that public record. And some of that information will also appear in our public catalog, which is an online catalog that you have to go through our website to get to. It's not really Google searchable. It's walled in a little bit on our website. But if you're looking for some personal information and you know a particular registration was made, you may be able to find that information. And that information could include addresses, phone numbers, and email addresses if provided in certain places on the application. Not all aspects of the application fall in the online catalog, but it is technically all part of the public record. So if somebody is has concerns or worries about providing certain personal information, the one that comes up the most is house addresses. You know, our system asks for an address, and that's usually just it's one area to identify a person. It's also an area in case we have correspondence or where a certificate needs to be mailed to. That address can be a business address. It can be a P.O. box. It doesn't necessarily have to be a home address. And again, some people even create alternate emails addresses just for the handling of their copyright issues. So they have a particular address that they make either through a a free online service or their service or their online service provider, where they'll create a sometimes a name a handle that's specific for them to filing copyright registrations, and they might only use that email simply for that. So there are ways to avoid certain information becoming public if that's a concern of a person. Most of the information that we ask really is basic information that could be found in other public sources outside of the Copyright Office. We do not ask for Social Security numbers, for example, so we don't want that. In fact, if somebody were handed in a paper form with that information, we will cross through it. We'll block that out because there's certain information we know is just too sensitive to make public. But, you know, people's phone numbers and addresses tend to be public record anyway. So there isn't anything heavy. If someone wants to not include the year they were born, for example, on an application, that is not a required field. Again, it's an area that's used as an identifier. It's a way to identify one person over versus another person. And if you choose to put that information, you do have to be aware that it will appear in our public catalog.
Oh, I see. I'm sure that's a very important question or aspect that people might want to know in view of this area where we live in now with privacy. What we're going to do now, John, to give you a chance to get a drink of water, we're going to take a little break and we'll be right back.
Okay.
You're grooving already. We're going to make y'all dance on this one. Introducing my man, B. Howard.
I don't need a reason. Got you, babe, by my side.
Welcome back, and our special guest today is Mr. John St. Amour from the United States Copyright Office. Welcome back, John.
Thank you.
We just finished talking about the different ways that we can actually send in the application. Okay, in that same thing, I want to send it in the mail. Are there any special mailing requirements that you ask if we send in an application through the mail?
Well, not really. We do like to make people aware that ever since the anthrax scare here on Capitol Hill, because we are in Washington, D.C., the U.S. Copyright Office is an agency within the Library of Congress. The Library of Congress is just about a par three away from the United States Capitol, if that far. And so ever since the anthrax scare, all mail that comes to the Capitol Hill area goes through screening through the United States Postal Service. That screening is called irradiation, which it's sort of like a big heater, if you will, but it's basically taking care of, on a molecular level, taking care of any possible anthrax. In some cases, the level of irradiation can damage deposit copies sent to our office. So we encourage, people to use, when you're sending us anything with plastic, like if you're sending us a CD with a jewel case or something like that, to pack it appropriately, to use a cardboard box paper, fill it with paper so that it doesn't get jostled around too much. And, just use a common sense approach to sending packages to Capitol Hill and having, you know, protection in that regards. Outside of that, there isn't really any major requirements. But just to be aware that we still screen for anthrax some 13 years later.
Right. All right, John, as an overview, can you give us some of the forms used for copyright? In particular, such as you have a form, an SR form, and I understand that means relative to sound recording. What are some of the other types of forms?
Well, these are paper forms. In the online system, there aren't different forms for different types of works. That's something that we've been doing only with the paper forms. As I said earlier, the paper forms have really remained basically unchanged since 1978. A few format differences, but if you take a form from 1978 and put it next to a form from 2008, they look pretty much the same. And those paper forms had different forms for different types of works. For example, if you're a visual artist, where you're creating sculptural works, graphic arts, photography, paintings, drawings, and works along those lines, you would use the VA form for visual arts. If you are creating a literary work, such as a book, a thesis, or a doctoral dissertation, or an article that's going to appear in a newspaper, or a newsletter, and those kinds of things, we have the TX form for that, which stands for text, for literary works. Now, the PA form stands for performing arts. So any of the works that would fall under the purview of the performing arts would use that form. And the final form was form SE for serial works. So if you created a magazine or anything published in volume and issues, you would use the SE form for that. And we had other various forms for group registration as well, which were usually added on additional forms to clarify an application. Again, all these paper forms are, like I said, is only about 6% of the registrations we get are still used on these paper forms. If you file through the online system, you won't see any of these forms. The online system is a universal system. All types of works get filtered through that same electronic system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the system will ask you what type of work are you registering, and you'll indicate to it that you're registering a literary work or a performing artwork or a visual artwork or a serial or a motion picture or a sound recording. So you'll tell it what you're registering, but you won't see any different form because the online system is universal. And as I said, about 94% registrations are coming in through that system, so they won't be using those various forms. But if you happen to be one of the 6% of the people who are using the paper forms, then you do want to be aware that there are different forms for different types of works, and you want to select the form that most represents the kind of work that you're registering with our office.
Okay, excellent. This has been so interesting, and I hate to really stop, but can you give us the address or the website that everybody can go on to get further answers to these questions?
Sure. Our website is www.copyright.gov. That's copyright.gov, which is short for government. Copyright.gov, or www.copyright.gov. And as I said earlier, it has a wealth of information. It has links to the law and the regulations. We have links to all sorts of upcoming things that may change in the copyright law. In fact, a person can subscribe to a service called NewsNet, and it's a free subscription. And in NewsNet, we send out all the latest information on any new legislation or new regulations that may be coming down the pike to keep people aware. We don't really have a lot of time to talk about this, but the current copyright law, you know, a lot of people have some complaints with the law in terms of how it supports or doesn't support all the new technologies that have come out in the last 20 years. Here's this Copyright Act from 1978, and here we are in 2014, and we've gone through a digital revolution or a digital industrialization, if you will. And the copyright law has some areas to help that need a little improvement in order to support that. We have had a patchwork of laws that have been passed obviously since 1978, to help support various industries. But we're currently under a massive review of the copyright law, which may result in a new copyright act. We may see in our lifetime the next great copyright act, which would be really exciting, especially for me who works here, to actually be working here when a brand new copyright act is enacted, if that happens. Your listeners are part of the stakeholders. They are the musicians. They are the writers. They are the visual artists. They are the people who are creating America, who are part of America's output, creative effort. And you are the people that copyright is trying to protect and help in your endeavor as an artist. And so we encourage you to be part of the conversation and join, subscribe to NewsNet and get all the latest information. You get an email maybe once a month with updates and things to look at. And when an area of law that might affect you comes under review, you want to know about it so that you can be a part of the conversation. We don't make laws. Well, we don't make the laws. Congress makes the laws. But Congress doesn't just willy-nilly make copyright laws. We put questionnaires out there. We ask stakeholders, what do they think about changes that might be needed in a particular law? What would be beneficial to them as, in this case, as artists? You know, how can copyright better serve you in your industries? And we take your input, and then we put out what the proposed legislation is from Congress or proposed rulemakings from our office. We put all that out there for people to comment on, and we take those very seriously because we are here for the American people and for the creative American people in particular. And so we want their input, and we want you to feel like the Copyright Office is a place that is here to support you, and so we want you to be involved in that. So obviously our website is a big part of that in terms of getting information out, but it's also a place where you can get involved through NewsNet and through participating when there's questions that go out to participate in that. And you're also going to notice at the end of this month a major revision of our website that we're doing in order to, again, better serve you. And many of those changes, to our website, which, as I said, mostly a place just put out information, but many of the changes came from discussions that we had with stakeholders who came and met with our technical advisors and our attorneys here to talk about how we can better provide information to the public. So when you see the new website come out, it's expected to come out June 30th. It will have all of this information in there, but it'll be formatted right differently. And just know that new website was an outcome of artists just like your listeners who participated and helped us shape our website.
That sounds absolutely marvelous. John, the show has been absolutely very informative, and I want to say thank you for joining us. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Mr. John St. Amour for the U.S. Copyright Office in Washington, D.C. Thank you, John.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye.
This is Andale Banks, your host of Wish Upon a Star, and Denise Banks, co-ordinator of Wish Upon a Star on BBSRadio.com Station 2, saying please tell others to listen in the first and third Wednesday of each month at 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. If you have any comments or suggestions, please send us an email to musicradio34@gmail.com. Repeating that, for any comments, musicradio34@gmail.com. Again, this is Andale Banks, your host of Wish Upon a Star, saying keep reaching for the stars.